Picture this. You're 3 hours into a cross country. Clear skies above, smooth air, and the destination is 90 miles ahead. You glanced at the fuel gauges an hour ago. They looked fine, and you haven't thought about them since. The headwind you picked up after your last checkpoint was a little stronger than forecast, but you're almost there. You'll make it, except you won't. I'm Pattern, and this is Traffic Pattern on Radio Hangar. And today we're talking about fuel. Specifically, we're talking about the accident that has no business happening in a modern cockpit, and yet the National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, keeps finding in the wreckage of general aviation aircraft year after year. Fuel exhaustion. The engine quit not because it broke, because the pilot ran out of gas. Before we get into the meat of this quick word from our friends at AviationSoul.com, they make challenge coins for every step of the journey. Got your first solo? There's a coin for that. Private pilot? Instrument? Commercial? They've got you covered. Great way to mark the milestones that matter. AviationSoul.com. Now, back to fuel. The regulation is Federal Aviation Regulation 91.151. Most student pilots have it memorized before check ride time, for visual flight rules or VFR day flight. You need enough fuel to reach your destination plus 30 minutes at cruise power. Night VFR, it's 45 minutes. Simple enough. And here is where the trap lives, because simple and sufficient are not the same thing. 30 minutes of fuel reserve sounds like a comfortable cushion. But let's do the actual math. A Cessna 172 burning 8 gallons per hour at cruise, which is a reasonable number for 55 to 65% power, uses about 4 gallons in 30 minutes. If your fuel gauges are reading even slightly optimistically, if your burn rate ran a little hotter than the book, because you climbed into a headwind, if you burned more during a longer climb than you planned, that 30-minute reserve can shrink to something more like 15. And 15 minutes is not a lot of margin when the nearest airport is 12 miles away. The Federal Aviation Administration publishes Advisory Circular 91-43 on VFR cross-country flight planning. The FAA's own guidance is explicit. The regulatory minimums in Federal Aviation Regulation 91.151 are a floor, not a goal. The regulation tells you the minimum you have to have. It does not tell you that it's a good idea to plan your flight so you arrive with 30 minutes and 1 second of fuel on board. So let's talk about what the actual planning process looks like. Because the regulation gives you a number, but it doesn't give you a method. Step 1, know your numbers before you ever walk to the airplane. Open your pilot's operating handbook, and I mean the one for the specific airplane you're flying, not a generic version, and find the fuel consumption table in the performance section. You're looking for your expected cruise power setting, your planned cruise altitude, and what the book says you'll burn at those conditions. And here's something I want you to pay attention to. Notice how different those numbers look at 55% power versus 75% power. In a Cessna 172, the difference might be 7.6 gallons per hour versus 9.8. That's more than 2 gallons per hour. On a 4-hour flight, that's almost 9 gallons more than an hour's worth of fuel at cruise. If you plan at 55% and fly at 75% because you're behind schedule, you're not flying the flight you planned. Also notice that climb burns more fuel than cruise. Most simplified fuel planning worksheets assume you're at cruise for the entire flight, but you're not. The climb from sea level to 6,500 feet in a Cessna 172 can take 15 to 20 minutes and burns fuel at a rate closer to 10 gallons per hour, not 8. On a short cross country, that might be a small difference. On a flight where you're already planning close to your maximum range, that climb fuel burn is the number that pushes you over the edge. Step 2, know what fuel you actually have. Total fuel is not usable fuel. In a standard Cessna 172S, total fuel capacity is 56 gallons. Usable fuel is 53. 3 gallons live in the tanks in a position the fuel system can never reach. They do not count. They have never counted. And if you're filling to the tabs, the fuel level markers inside the tank know exactly what quantity those tabs represent in your specific aircraft. Different configurations and different tank designs put the tab at different levels. Now about the gauges themselves. Federal Aviation Regulation 23.1357 requires only that the fuel gauge read zero when the usable fuel is gone. That is the only accuracy requirement. The gauge can read anything it wants between full and empty, and it's legally compliant. Fuel gauges in light aircraft are notoriously unreliable. The only times a fuel gauge in a small airplane is truly accurate are when you just topped it off and the gauge reads full, and when the tank is empty and the engine is stopping. For a fuel-critical cross-country, the fuel cap and a calibrated fuel measuring stick are your actual instruments. Dip the tanks. Verify visually. Do not trust the panel gauge for a long flight. Step 3. Build a fuel schedule and stick to it. This is the habit I make every one of my students practice before their long cross-country solo. Before you start the engine, write down the time and your total fuel on board. Then, every 30 minutes in the air, log the time, note your fuel gauge reading, and compute your expected remaining fuel based on your planned burn rate. If those two numbers, what the gauge says and what your math says, start to diverge, you catch it early, while you still have a comfortable fuel state and a runway within gliding distance. The log doesn't require anything sophisticated, a knee pad and a pencil. What it requires is that you actually look at the fuel situation on a schedule instead of assuming it's fine because nothing has gone wrong yet.
A lot of pilots in fuel exhaustion accidents knew they were getting low. The NTSB reports make this clear. They could read the gauges. Some of them even acknowledged to passengers that the fuel situation was something to keep an eye on, and they pressed on anyway, because they were close. Because the destination airport was just over the next ridge, because stopping meant delay and inconvenience feels very heavy in the cockpit when you can see where you're trying to go. That is get-home-itis. It is at the center of more fuel exhaustion accidents than almost any other single factor, and it does not feel like recklessness when you're in it. It feels like reasonable optimism. That is exactly what makes it dangerous. Step 4. Plan your alternates with fuel built in, not bolted on. Your fuel alternate on a cross-country should not be an emergency landing strip. It should be a planned option with a comfortable fuel margin to reach it. Identify airports along your route of flight that have fuel available. Know where they are before you depart. If you arrive over your fuel alternate and your calculated fuel state has dropped to legal minimums, land. The destination can wait. The trip can be rescheduled. A fuel exhaustion accident cannot be walked back. I teach students to plan fuel stops at roughly 2/3 of their maximum range rather than the maximum. Flying to maximum range burns your reserve and leaves you no margin for headwinds, a longer routing, a delay in the pattern, or a missed approach at the destination. Flying to 2/3 means you arrive at your fuel stop with a healthy reserve, refuel, and continue. The inconvenience of one extra fuel stop is not remotely comparable to the consequences of the alternative. Now let's talk about winds, because headwinds are the factor that most often turns a reasonable fuel plan into an emergency.
The winds aloft forecast, the FD product in ForeFlight on avwx.weather.gov or on the Aviation Weather Center site at aviationweather.gov, is one of the more accurate weather products we have. But it's a forecast, not a guarantee. A 20 knot tailwind that turns into a 20 knot headwind is a 40 knot swing in ground speed. In a Cessna 172 cruising at 110 knots, that increases your block time by roughly 45% on a long leg, and your fuel burn goes with it. Here's something I wish someone told me early in my training. Pull the winds aloft forecast for multiple altitudes, not just your planned cruise altitude, and pull it for multiple time periods across your flight. Winds shift through the day. The winds when you depart might be quite different from the winds 3 hours into your flight. Look at the trends. If the forecast is showing a strengthening headwind component later in the day, that matters. My personal rule is a 10% headwind contingency. If my winds aloft forecast shows any meaningful headwind component on the route, I add 10% to my estimated fuel burn for planning purposes. It costs me almost nothing to carry that buffer, and it gives me a margin when the forecast is off. Let me address the airman certification standards directly, because if you're in private pilot training, this is exactly what your examiner is evaluating. The Airman Certification Standards, or ACS, require that you demonstrate the ability to compute fuel required, including reserve fuel for a cross-country flight. That is a direct quote. The examiner wants to see the actual computation. Your fuel burn rate, your estimated flight time, your climb fuel, your reserve, your contingency. Not just a line that says fuel, legal plus reserve. Show the work. The ACS also requires that you identify appropriate fuel stops along your route and demonstrate the ability to recognize when a divert for fuel is necessary. Your examiner may give you an in-flight scenario where your headwind is worse than forecast and ask you what you do next. Have an answer before you walk into that oral. Know where your fuel alternates are. Know at what point you would make the call to land short of your destination. That is not defeat. That is aeronautical decision-making, and the examiner will recognize it as such. One more item before we wrap, because it comes up in the accident reports more than people expect. Fuel imbalance and tank switching. On a Cessna 172, you fly on left tank, right tank, or both. The standard practice is to alternate tanks at regular intervals to keep the fuel load balanced. On a long cross-country with everything else going on, navigating, talking to flight service, monitoring traffic, looking at weather, tank switching is the thing that slips. If you run the left tank close to dry while the right still has 7 or 8 gallons, you do not have 7 or 8 gallons of reserve.
you have a left tank that is about to interrupt fuel flow to the engine. The fuel injected Lycoming in most modern Cessna 172s will quit on fuel exhaustion in the selected tank, even if the other tank is full. And recovery from that, even if you switch tanks immediately, may take a moment. A moment that requires altitude you may not have. Set a timer for tank switches before takeoff. 30 minutes on each side or whatever your aircraft's fuel management procedure specifies, stick to it. Put it in your flow, same as mixture or altimeter. The fuel exhaustion accident file at the NTSB is searchable at ntsb.gov. I encourage you to spend an hour with it, read 10 or 15 of those reports. You will notice very quickly how consistently they share the same structure. A pilot who knew the fuel situation was marginal, a series of decisions that each seemed reasonable in the moment, and an outcome that was entirely preventable at multiple points along the way. The engine does not care how close you are to the destination. It runs on fuel, and when fuel is gone, it stops. Every pilot who has ever been in a fuel exhaustion accident has passed at least two or three decision points where they could have landed, refueled, and continued. The goal of fuel planning is to make sure you see those decision points for what they are, not obstacles, but options, while you still have the fuel state to use them. My sources today include the National Transportation Safety Board Accident Database, Federal Aviation Regulation 91.151, the Cessna 172 Pilots Operating Handbook, and FAA Advisory Circular 91-43, more at radiohanger.com. I'm Pattern. See you next time.